You know, in the old days, we used to, in the old days, in old country, Minnesota, with Katagiri, we had this, we were talking about this monastic form of Zen, because that's what they brought, because that's what had inspired them. The most inspiring form of Zen took place in the monastery. So in the Japanese monastery, you do one thing at a time, and you don't look and listen at the same time either. It's always one thing at a time. So in a Dharma talks, everyone sits like this, looking down. No one makes eye contact. And in fact, no one made eye contact ever, pretty much. The combination of Japan and Minnesota was unbeatable. No one made eye contact much, but I can't hear without looking, seeing. It doesn't work so well. So I would sit there and, you know, look at Katagiri. He never seemed to mind. And then, in fact, he would look back, you know, wonder of wonders. And then I found the first time when I gave a talk there, I thought everybody had gone completely to sleep because their eyes looked closed. There was no one made eye contact. There were all these impassive faces and absolutely no eye contact. And I was just felt awful. I had put everybody to sleep. But that's, so we don't do it that way anymore. So I like to have some sense of eye contact. That's one reason we started with our breakfasts, you know, sitting around the table, was because eye contact and talking to each other like this is essential. So here we are. And I think it's that, in a way, that eye contact that led me to decide that what I want to talk about in Sesshin is different pieces of the what is said in the ordination ceremony. Not the meaning of ordination, but what is said in the words of that ceremony. There I was saying these words, looking at these guys, and the first thing that got me going was the verse that says, as we'll talk about tomorrow, that says, in the karmic life of past, present, and future, attachment cannot be cut off. I said, how come I've never noticed this verse before? You know, there's so much else going on. I've never really paid attention to that verse. So I realized I love that. There were so many interesting things. What do you mean? You took refuge in the Buddha as the perfect teacher and the Dharma as the complete teaching. You mean that? What does that mean? You know? So that's another. That's also coming one of these days. So I just picked out pieces that I found were juicy for me, hoping they'll be juicy for you. And the first one is the idea of accepting something, whether it's the Dharma or taking on something, as the great responsibility for one's entire lifetime. Thinking even in those terms. That was at the beginning of the ceremony. And when I speak these various parts in the ceremony, not the verses, but the sort of prose sections, they're my takes or interpretations of the traditional ceremony. I'm not just inventing them, and I'm not taking them quite word for word. But these are basically what's been said, and in some cases maybe restated. So I also, the first section is partly my take on wanting to include the group in what's happening, which also didn't always happen. In Japan, when we performed a ceremony, say the monastery is very interesting. Now, if you perform a wedding, a funeral, lots of people come or are invited in. That's part of it. But a ceremony doesn't require an audience. I always thought it did. You know, what do? You have a ceremony and people come. In that context, I saw the way in which it is. In fact, a ceremony is always a performance of a kind. But what you're performing, you don't have to have anyone else there. We would rehearse and train and practice and then perform ceremonies that were taken and understood by the priests, the women priests performing them, as meaningful in themselves, quite apart from any audience. It wasn't just because we were training. It was because that was the meaning of it, was the doing of the ceremony. So the ordination ceremony doesn't have to have anyone else there to be, I mean, theoretically, ordination, you have to have a few people there to say this is a valid ordination. But for instance, the Dharma transmission, there's ceremonies that take place just privately. Those are just between the two people. But so then when those teachers would come here, they would have a ceremony, and they wouldn't explain anything. The people would sit there kind of blinking. You didn't really quite know where you're going or how you were getting there, because here's the ceremony, and you just get to sort of watch it. But our way is much more, my way certainly, is to include people. So I have added a little bit into the ceremonies that way. At any rate, I start out saying that this particular ceremony of priest ordination means dedicating your life to the Dharma. But then I say, one accepts the Dharma as the great responsibility for one's entire lifetime. Well, that's just one piece of it. Some people say, I'm going to take the Dharma as a responsibility for my entire lifetime by putting on the robes. You don't have to put on the robes to do that, but you can take something else as that. But what does it mean to say, I have a lifetime in which I have a great responsibility as living this lifetime? So what does it mean to have a great responsibility for your lifetime? What does it mean to think in those terms? Now, it doesn't mean, this is not a way to inflate ourselves. We are each very small and ordinary beings. But at the same time, we're living out these precious human lives. And they are precious, and they are rare, and they are painful, and they are precious, and they are rare. So we have this little cycle, a little circle. It hurts, it's precious, it's rare. It hurts, it's precious, it's rare. But it is all those things. The precious human life is rarely achieved. Ants don't have it. Beetles have beetle lives. Skunks have pretty nice skunk lives. But there is something very precious in the human life. And we have this opportunity. Now, this is not to say that responsibility of a life should be a great weight, because that's another place we can easily go with it. We have a precious human life that has great gifts in it. And our gifts are also the source of a great deal of suffering, which is one reason we shy away from having a sense of taking responsibility for our lives. That's what it's saying. What is the great responsibility of your lifetime? Is to say, I want to be responsible for my life. And not knowing quite what that means, and fearing we'll be driven into a corner where we're really going to be stuck with the unending suffering of it somehow. That's kind of the fear of it. Because we have great gifts, and they are also the sources of suffering, great suffering. So I was thinking, what are some of these great gifts that I think of as belonging to this part, as past aspects of this preciousness of a human life? Well, our appetite for life and our sensitivity to life's events. We are very sensitive creatures. We don't have noses like dogs, to be sure. But we have many senses with which we are exquisitely sensitive to our environment. And we have an appetite for life and for sensing. This is a being that wants to sense and has very refined ways to do it, and wants to sense, and wants to sense. And we have a perhaps unique, every creature is unique, our unique human capacity to keep refining that sensitivity to life, which is our way of connecting. So this appetite and sensitivity to life or to life's events is a great human gift. And we have minds that can conceive of a self running through past, present, and future. This is a very good thing. Without that, you wouldn't know who you were. You wouldn't know where you were yesterday. You wouldn't recognize Julia when you went home at night. You know, we have this past. Well, you might by scent, if you're a dog, right? You'd recognize your kids, but you sniff them. But we have a kind of awareness of a self of yesterday that interacted with another self of yesterday, and that we are made of our yesterdays. We have an awareness of this. We don't just act it out blindly. We do act it out blindly, but we don't only act it out blindly. We have this awareness of past, present, and future is a great gift as well as a great problem for us. It's a great gift because we can say, here I am. I don't think you can have something that would be called a moral life or a life of a human accountability if you didn't have a sense of past, present, and future, of past actions, a past sort of pouring into or filling this vessel called this moment and pouring on into the future. We certainly would have a lot greater difficulty learning from the past if we didn't have an awareness of past and present and the difference and connectedness of them. And another one of our great gifts is the ability to love, which requires a sense of self, the human way of loving. People doing research with infants, I presume it's not child abuse when you do research with a one-year-old because they're just watching them gently. But you know, there's always, you have to be very careful with them. But they're at 1 year old, some little kids will try to help someone, give something, someone something that they've dropped, or see distress on a face and want to reach out. The ability to love and to give comes from deep inside, but it also very much involves the sense of here I am, here you are, there's something in me that wants to connect with you. And each of these great gifts, and any other one you want to name, has a shadow side of suffering that's not separable from the gift. So the appetite for and sensitivity to all the events of life hurts. Suffering, pain and suffering. That very basic sensitivity is often experienced as pain. Pain is saying, ooch, that's too much. Ooch, that's not good for this one. It's one of the sensitive responses. If we had blunter responses, we wouldn't feel so much pain. And our appetite for the events of life thwarted is suffering. Our appetite for life is our expression of life energy, and when it's thwarted, that is suffering. And we have this self-minds that can conceive of a self running through past, present, and future, and we have this mind that can conceive of how awful I am, or how I did it wrong, or how bad I am. We have this mind that can conceive of tremendous things. A mind that can understand a sense of past, present, and future and ways in which they are made of each other. This is a beautiful thing, a rare and beautiful thing. And it's also then quickly turns into self versus other, self that must be protected from possible future hurts based on how we remember the past. Fear and anger come up out of this same mind seeing a self running from past, present to future. The self that sees the runningness, the mind that sees the runningness of self through past, present and future and the changing of it wants to build a little solidity and a little permanence somewhere, and that's of course doomed. It is fighting the natural, the nature of life and the nature of reality, building a house on a little ice floe. And that gift of the ability to love. Well, then what happens when our love is thwarted from inside or from outside? Then we have loss, fear of love, betrayal. So we have these great gifts, precious human life, and the tremendous problem that these gifts are the source of a great deal of suffering. Confusion. So what's the great responsibility for a lifetime? It can't be to somehow not have any shadow to your gifts, because everything casts a shadow in this world. So I take the great responsibility of my life, or even of our lives, as to be as fully human as we can, and to figure out what for ourselves that might mean. To fulfill this gift of protoplasm, of protoplasmic humanity, and the gift of life, the gift of air, the gift of water, the gift of food, the gift of companionship, the gift of Dharma. Those are gifts that are sufficient for me to take up the question, what is it to be fully human? They don't answer it. We can't say, oh, look, I should be happy. I have, what's the famous word, should. I have life and air and water and food and shelter, and I'm not in Haiti, you know, and I have a reasonable expectation of a lifespan and, you know, some money coming in. You know, I'm kind of maybe wobbly, but here I am. I should be happy? No, no, no. But I should, if there's a should, is feel that on that basis I can take up the important questions. Like, what is it to be fully human? What does it mean? What kind of happiness is what we want to go toward? How do you even define that? Sometimes we take the question of what is it to be fully human as a question for settling down in quiet, in peace. And there I will be able to unpack that question. And that's also true. I found Zazen, which isn't always peace and quiet, to be a great place to live out that question, to experience being fully human, not with my mind, to experience being human. But most importantly, how do you take up the question of what is it to be fully human in the middle of the turbulent waters of your life? Because that's where we live. How can you meet the sufferings of your life and not be crushed by them? And not only not be crushed by them, but flourish. The only way to flourish is to be able to take nourishment from all the foods offered. It's very difficult to take nourishment not only in the middle of suffering, but from the suffering itself. Very difficult. And often we can't see when we are suffering, actively suffering, or acutely suffering, or even chronically suffering. We have acute and chronic forms. We can't see how it is that we are taking any nourishment. And someone says, you know, crisis is opportunity, you want to punch them. And yet, the saying, this is my life, taking up the question, what is it to be fully human? Not the answer, but the question in a time of suffering helps that be part of your life. Well, I'm being fully human and suffering here. Thank you very much. That's what I'm doing right now. And that will inform your life because it's been taken in as part of your life. You know, in a way, the Dharma is about what's called adventitious suffering. We can't staunch the blood that flows. And bones break, lives part, lives end, jobs are lost, houses burn. These things happen. And it would be bizarre not to grieve or feel pain at them. The Dharma doesn't address that. It addresses the, what you might say, adventitious suffering, the suffering we pile on top of that, where we resist. That's why pain medication is so useful, not so much for the original pain, but for the pain, the suffering caused by the resisting the pain. Which for most of us especially in our psychological and emotional lives, is the greater share. Where the turbulence in our lives, a great deal of it, is this resistance or fear or anger. Those are all forms of resistance to what how things are. That's the adventitious suffering. See, it's not integral to the situation. It's what's added to it. Or our reaction to it, in addition to the fact that there's something wrong here, something problematic here. And the Dharma is one of the best things I've ever encountered for that. And I don't want to turn this into why the Dharma is a good answer to what is the direction of your life. For me, it's just a basic underpinning of whatever kind of life one may choose to live, because the Dharma is, at root, this natural universe in which we live, in which nothing can be held on to, yet everything can it calls out to be met and accepted. That's the Dharma underneath the things we call Dharma teachings. But really the large question of how do you go in the direction of being fully human? What is the great responsibility for your entire lifetime? And how can you to go in the direction of that question, you have to deal with, make sense of the word responsible. We don't usually think in terms of having an entire lifetime. We think of today. Maybe 2 days, maybe the 5 days of session, maybe this week or this month. But an entire lifetime is not a frame we usually think in terms of. I think we're mostly a little bit afraid that we won't be able to measure up, that we set up some ideal that we couldn't measure up to. It's not really about an ideal. But the problem of it really is in the front end here, this word responsible. What does it mean to be responsible for your lifetime, for the meaning of your life? The word responsibility gets very heavy very fast. It leads to a lot of guilt, right, for not being sufficiently responsible. But responsible does not mean burden. First of all, it comes from the word response. And I like to see in it a combination of the word of the response and sensibility. Sensibility not doesn't mean sensible, but sense of temperament or sensing. What if you saw it as response and sensitive, for instance? My sensibility is my sensitivity to life. And my response to what I sense is being accountable. So we might say, instead of responsible, the great accountability for one's entire lifetime. But people think that means a judgment. I'm not responsible for any of you, but I am accountable to all of you. And that's why I show up when I don't want to. I'm also accountable to myself, and I show up for that reason too. Not just for you, but I show up because it's not exactly responsible, it's accountable, because this is the chosen direction and we have a mutuality here. If I don't show up, It leaves other people's lives a little bit wobblier, because that peace that was part of a reasonable part of their world or day just, you know, took off. And so there's accountability is a mutual thing, being accountable to our own practice. We need each other for that. I wouldn't be as serious with my practice if I weren't accountable to all of you. Now, when I was young, I didn't need anybody else in my practice. I just sat every day in my cabin in the woods, day after day after day after day after day. Occasionally went out for session, didn't talk to anybody, came home again. So I wasn't accountable to anybody. But I had to creep out of my cabin in the woods eventually, go to Minnesota and find people to practice with and to learn to be mutually accountable. And then my practice expanded enormously. Well, the question of what is the great responsibility for your entire lifetime is how do you want to respond to life? How do you want life to respond to you? And how do you want to see that as something going in the direction of a coherence carried from past to present to future? Because your lifetime could end tomorrow, or mine could end today. Especially in the stormy weather, all those old trees, when one's going to go crunch down on us. So who knows how long a lifetime is? It's vast, and it's as real as right now. So the great responsibility for your lifetime is as vivid as this moment, and no more and no less. One of the wonderful things about Dharma, as I've come to understand it, is that I am still living out my vow or my intention, even when I'm still in the Dharma role, even when I forget about it. It's not when I'm forgotten what I'm about. I kind of live a crumpled little life, and I live a crumpled form of the Dharma. And then every now and then I remember, and I kind of expand and settle, and a clearer, uncrumpled person. It expresses a clear and uncrumpled form of Dharma. But I'm always there. The world doesn't abandon us, even when we forget about it. Therefore, it's there to return to. The awareness, is waking up, is there to return to. Let me sometimes call that Buddha nature, right? The world is already the world of Dharma, the world of our own lives, the world of our intentions, the world of our vows, the world of the people in our lives. This world is there. And we forget and we return. Our bodies are like that. So we do that in Zazen. Zazen is our sometimes painful playpen, in a sense. It's our little paradigm in which we say, I forget what it's like to be me. It's peekaboo. We're still kids playing peekaboo. I forget I'm alive. I forget I'm here. I'm off having a cobwebby story. And every time I return, there's being here. Beyond whether it's happy or sad or painful, there's being here. And that's like a heartbeat that is always available. The waking up is always available, and there's always a world into which to awaken. This is the mind that naturally accords. When inverted thinking stops, when our cuckoo mind lets go for a minute, the mind that is not crumpling life up into little bits naturally accords with reality, and we naturally experience ourselves. And then we go off into cloud cuckoo land again. But it will. The world is still here. Life is still here for us to return to. But it's very precious, and it won't always be here. And we do have this wake up, because life is, who knows if it's short or long. And it is your precious human life. That exhortation should not be taken as a pressure. That's why I haven't posted that. There was a little exchange with some of the other Zen teachers about the verse. It's often the verse on the Han. That says, you know, life is short, or life is a shrinking pool, even. And life is fleeting. Wake up, wake up, wake up. It's put in many forms. I haven't put that up because it tends to lead us into a kind of a pressured, a push. I must push to something. And that's not it at all. Pushing pushes you out of this moment. What we want to do is arrive in this moment where we're actually living our entire life right now, where we're accountable to ourselves and our others. And so the people, other people in our lives who aren't here today, we're still accountable to them by what we're doing now and here. We're not abandoning them by being here. What is the great responsibility of your life, or the great direction for your life? And don't belittle yourself, anyone. any one of you by saying, oh, I don't have a great direction. Maybe you do, Jisho, you know, here you are being a Zen priest, but I have only small concerns. That's not it. That's not it. I needed a really strong container to keep me reminding myself that I even have such a thing as a person or a vow in a direction. It's not better, it's not worse. Being responsible for your life and fulfilling your life does not mean scaling tall buildings at a single bound. It does mean committing your life to life, not necessarily to a great cause, not at all. It doesn't mean shaving your head. It means taking your life seriously. That's really what it comes down to. Taking your life seriously, taking yourself seriously, including deserving of peace and contentment, deserving of being able to say, I want to be here, sitting here. Deserving of the effort to find what it is to love other people and be loved by them. That may be the great responsibility for a lifetime, is taking yourself seriously. And find your own form for that. Find your expression for that. Take yourself seriously. I suppose I could say everyone here, in a way, we're declaring that just by coming here and being here. But we keep forgetting as we kind of get through the day or the suffering on the shoulders. Take your great life seriously and enjoy it.